All right, the last matter on for argument today is Center for Biological Diversity versus United States Environmental Protection Agency, 25-2738. Okay, I can't help but notice I have a lot of people sitting up here, but I only have one person arguing on each side. Am I right on that? Okay.
Right, Judge Cahen.
Okay, so each side has 20 minutes. Good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Allison LaPlante on behalf of Petitioner Center for Biological Diversity. I'd like to try to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
EPA's pesticide general permit, which also authorizes the discharge of highly toxic pesticides into the nation's waters, fails for two fatal reasons. First, the permit unlawfully exempts 97% of the dischargers from having to do anything to receive blanket permit coverage based on arbitrary line drawing, leaving the agency and the public in the dark about the vast majority of dischargers. And second, the permit violates the Clean Water Act because it contains an ineffectual, an illogical one-size-fits-all visual monitoring requirement that calls for monitoring in name only and renders the permit toothless. So to begin, the permit unlawfully exempts 97% of the dischargers from having to submit the most basic information in the form of a notice of intent, or we call an NOI.
So would you agree that no provision of the Clean Water Act explicitly governs the requirements for who must submit an NOI under a general permit or how much information the NOI must collect?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. The statute itself is silent on the concept of NOI. It was created by regulation from EPA.
So if the NOI requirements are governed only by agency regulation, what standard of review do we apply in reviewing the 2026 permits NOI requirements?
Well, Judge Callahan, I would submit we actually do have to start with the statute because the statute matters. There may be some ambiguity as to what a general permittee has to do to be covered by a permit. The statute is absolutely clear on two things. First, Section 301 of the statute, that's 33 U.S.C. 1311, is unambiguous that in order to discharge a pollutant into water in the United States, you have to have a permit. So there's no ambiguity there. And then Clean Water Act Section 402A2 requires that EPA shall develop permit conditions, including data and information collection and reporting, to assure compliance with the substantive terms of the MPDS program. That means guarantee compliance, and it strains reason to conclude that EPA could assure compliance by interpreting its NOI regulation to exempt the vast majority of dischargers from even having to announce who they are or provide basic information about what and where they're discharging toxic pesticides.
Is there a permissible percentage of pesticide dumping that doesn't require a permit?
Your Honor, an NOI should be...
You say 97% is exempted, right? Are you arguing that there is a permissible one and 97% is above it?
Your Honor, we would submit that every entity under this permit should submit a notice of intent. It is not a big burden. It is a roughly 4-page online form.
And general permit, exemptions from NOI cannot be at all used by the agency?
Your Honor, there may be an instance in which EPA's regulation could be appropriately applied if there was truly some evidence that we are talking about a de minimis amount of pollution and there's no value to knowing anything about it. We don't have those facts here, and we submit that EPA cannot interpret its regulation to swallow the rule and require the vast majority of permittees to not submit any basic information.
Well, okay, but part of the determination for which entities must submit an NOI depends on certain quote-unquote annual treatment area thresholds. And you argue that the EPA unlawfully relies on this metric. But in your public comments, didn't you agree that area-based thresholds were lawful, even if you thought they should be reduced for each pesticide use pattern?
We did, Your Honor, in the comments as a means of helping EPA move the ball forward. And so our brief is simply saying that when EPA did the line drawing to determine who gets swept into the universe of this permit by submitting an NOI or report, EPA did not support that line drawing with actual factual analysis in the record. And so in our comments, because this is the fourth iteration of the permit, the center has been involved from day one in helping move this permit forward. We were simply offering a means by which EPA could eventually get to ultimate 100% NOI coverage through the permit. And what's important to note, Judge Callahan, about the analysis that that EPA did when it determined which entities would be exempt or inappropriate to require an NOI, is that it did not, even though its own regulations require the agency to consider toxicity, it didn't do so. At 2 ER 282 is EPA's, quote, toxicity analysis. It's two sentences long. And in the way that EPA has done this, it has grouped all of the pesticides together and hasn't taken account for the fact that not all pesticides are equal. So, for example, if the court looks at the record, we see that what we know from 2022 under this permit, which is, again, very limited information because most people don't have to report their discharges. But in 2022, we know that two of the top pesticides that were discharged under the permit by volume were diazinon and rotenone. Now, diazinon is an organophosphate chemical, a highly toxic neurotoxin, and rotenone is considerably less toxic. And so if you imagine a stream and someone discharging 1,000 pounds of rotenone is probably less dangerous than 10 pounds of diazinon. But EPA does this line drawing where it just assumes toxicity and discharge, or excuse me, volume track with the area that's treated. And the record does not actually support that conclusion. And EPA's determination that it's captured the, quote, significant dischargers, A, is untethered to the statute, and B, is also not supported by the record. It also ignores the fact that there could be cumulative impacts from, quote, smaller dischargers on the same body of water where we might know about a particular larger discharger.
Okay, so also in the public comment on the draft 2026 permit, you appeared to agree that visual monitoring can satisfy the EPA's statutory requirements. So is your argument only about the frequency or extent of visual monitoring that the permit requires?
Certainly, Your Honor. In our comments, we, again, in an effort to help EPA move the ball forward, suggested some ways to improve on the visual monitoring. The biggest problem with what EPA's...
So, I mean, what I'm hearing you say is don't listen to what I said there, because I was saying it for a different reason, only to move the ball forward.
And no, we stand by those comments, Your Honor. For example, one of the very specific things we said to improve the visual monitoring is that EPA could require the permittee to go back a couple of hours later or a day later. The biggest problem with the way the visual monitoring requirement is set up in this permit is that it is contemporaneous with the discharge. So nothing in our comments deters from that as the central point of our concern here. Visual monitoring may be appropriate in some circumstances, but a discharger is not likely to learn anything from looking at the very moment that it discharges. EPA even recognizes this in its fact sheet at 2 ER 267. It recognizes some of the practical difficulties with just requiring this one-size-fits-all visual monitoring requirement, yet that's what it did. It did not take us up on our suggestion to even make the permittees go back and look the next day. If the court goes back to even this court's decision in Headwaters versus Talon Irrigation District, which is sort of what pushed EPA to begin regulating discharges to begin with, that was about a fish kill that happened and that from the application of pesticides. The fish kill was not evident until the following day after the pesticides were applied. And I think the other important factor for the court to consider here is that there are four different pesticide use patterns grouped together with this one-size-fits-all monitoring requirement. And if you take one of those, for example, aerial canopy spraying, and you imagine spraying out of an airplane over a very dense canopy, and eventually the residue hits the water. It is basically impossible for the permittee to contemporaneously monitor what the effects are of that discharge that's done in that dense area. So
in that situation, what type of monitoring would you want?
Well, Judge Bumate, we believe that EPA should consider treating each of the pesticide use patterns differently. And we Sure. And so it may be the case that if EPA actually analyzes this, it could determine that water quality sampling is necessary before and after a pesticide application. There may be practicability concerns depending on, yes, depending on the exact nature of the application, but simply throwing its hands up in the air and saying, this is too difficult for us to figure out, we're just going to require one-size-fits-all visual monitoring is not consistent with the statute.
I'm just, isn't that exactly the type of thing that we leave, you know, the government to do? Figuring out what's, you know, the cost-benefit analysis of monitoring situation.
Certainly, Judge Bumate, but EPA has not created a record to show why what they did here works for all four of these situations.
Did I understand you to say in the beginning that you think that anyone that discharges a pesticide in whatever amount should fill out an NOI?
Yes, Your Honor.
What authority do you have for that?
Well, just going back to the...
I mean, that's your wish list. Uh-huh. But I mean, if the government doesn't do that, do you automatically win?
The best authority, Your Honor, is against Section 402A2 of the statute because it requires the collection of information to assure compliance. And so in order to get even the most basic information, EPA should require notices of intent. And what also comes along with having to file a notice of intent is that at the end of the year, they actually have to report on the volume, what they discharge, what pesticides, and where. That is relevant information that we aren't getting from 97% of the dischargers that are subject to this permit.
Is there any limits to that? I mean, the you know, that person, a gardener using pesticides, they I assume on their house they would not need to fill out an NOI.
Likely not, Your Honor. There are other jurisdictional hooks under the Clean Water Act that would trigger a permit, such as the discharge must be from a point source, and typically just your individual person is not considered a point source. So there are all the other elements. But what we do know about the pesticide use patterns that are covered by this permit is that they do meet the elements required for an NPDES permit. So now EPA in its brief suggests in its attempt to say that it's only ruled out those insignificant dischargers and that we're talking about small farmers. There's nothing in the record that supports this small farmer theory. In fact, what EPA, on page 44 of EPA's brief, it relies on its supplemental ER that it submitted, which includes an analysis done in 2011, and things have changed quite a bit, so that was when the permit was first developed. And then it includes citations to comments from small farmers back when the permit was first in draft form. And when that happened, It was kind of a change in the regulatory regime with that first Ninth Circuit case that I referred to, Talent Irrigation District, and then the Sixth Circuit and National Cotton Council in 2009 sort of really closed the door on EPA's attempt to exempt these dischargers. So the sort of world changed in between 2009 and 2011. I think there might have been some concern that this permit was going to capture all of these small farmers. So those are just comments. There's no actual factual record evidence that if we were to require NOIs from anyone who wants to get coverage under this permit, that would be your neighbor or a small farmer down the street. It's basic to the NPDES program that if you want coverage, you raise your hand and say, I want coverage, and EPA takes note of that.
What type of finding would you want EPA to give then to say that?
What type of finding, Judge Bumate?
Because you're saying it's that the record doesn't support this cutoff, you know. What would they need to do?
Well, I think part your question, Your Honor, goes to I think part of the problem with this whole scheme is that it's kind of a problem of EPA's own making because it has never required information from so many dischargers who would get liability coverage here that EPA can't really point to what is that universe, like can't really give us a full picture of that universe of permittees. And so by requiring basic information on an NOI form, that at least is a step in the direction of understanding what's really happening out there. Again, EPA seems to have made a lot of its line drawing based on this notion of burden, which is also not supported in the record. As I said, it's a four-page form online. What we do know from, I believe, the last time EPA analyzed this was in 2011, and the basic NOI form was estimated to cost a discharger $30 to complete. Perhaps more money if that discharger is discharging into areas that have endangered species. But so the myth of this being such a burdensome process that supports the line drawing is just not supported by the record. And it's also, again, not tied to the statute that says they have to assure compliance.
So you claim that 97% of the people the polluters are exempted. Is when I asked the government, the NOI submission requirements, will they exempt nearly 97% of the covered permittees? Are they going to agree with your 97% number?
Well, I would be interested to hear counsel's answer on that, because in their briefing, they say it's a number that they do not adopt, even though the number was derived by the expert Fish and Wildlife Service, National Marine Fisheries Service, and Fish and Wildlife Service. They derived that number based on information of EPA's. So the EPA has not put forward another number. I do not believe that EPA can disagree with the general statement that the NOI requirement and the reporting requirement is not applicable to the vast majority. If they have another number, it will be news to me as well. If it's okay with the court, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Rachel Martinez for respondents. And with me at council table, I have Alec Mully from the United States EPA. This court hears argument today on EPA's pesticide general permit under the Clean Water Act. The pesticide general permit is limited to four states and most federal lands. Beyond that, states and territories run their own pesticide general permit programs. The pesticide applications that this permit authorizes are important for public health, for example, to prevent the spread of infectious diseases, among other benefits. Any pesticide under this permit is already regulated by the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, or FIFRA.
So to fully comply with the biological opinions by NMFS and FWS, you agreed to develop and require permittees to use a geospatial mapping tool. Is that tool available yet?
It appears that the tool is delayed at this time and will not be in effect by the effective date of the permit, but EPA is undertaking steps to develop that and at that point to develop that reasonable and prudent alternative.
So you're still planning to develop it, but have NMFS or Fish and Wild Services raised any concerns about that process with you?
No, Your Honor. And like I said, EPA, you're correct, EPA is still intending on implementing this and is taking steps to develop it. The record and permit itself imposes an alternative method for permittees to use. So EPA contemplated circumstances, and the record is very clear that EPA contemplated a circumstance where the geospatial tool may not be available. And because of that, it reasonably implemented this alternative method where all permittees are required to utilize the service's own mapping tools. And in fact, Your Honor, the services themselves, in their biological opinion, recognize that there may be some sort of a situation that occurs that this geospatial tool isn't going to be available and that this alternative approach is going to be available. So while EPA is still intending to implement this remaining RPA and will eventually...
is there a timeline for it?
I do not have a timeline for you right now, Your Honor. But again, this is a record review case where the court is reviewing the record and the permit, and the permit provides a reasonable alternative that with implementation of that, I would like to note that it does the same thing as the geospatial tool, just in a slightly more clunky manner. Yes, so permittees still see where their areas overlap with the endangered species habitats and listed species.
So petitioners argue that your NOI submission requirements will exempt nearly 97% of all covered permittees. Is that accurate? And how does the number of exempted permittees related to the permitted discharges that EPA is most concerned about?
Sure, Your Honor. So starting with the 97% figure, and then I'll go to how that relates to the, quote, exempt folks that do not need to submit a notice of intent. EPA does not adopt the 97% figure, and I'm glad that we're able to talk about this so I can provide a little bit of clarity about why that figure is not something EPA adopts for the purpose of the actual universe of individuals who are not required to submit a notice of intent. So the figure comes, as petitioners noted, from the biological opinions of the services. These figures were based on EPA's 2011 economic analysis. And the 2011 economic analysis made very conservative assumptions to assure that economic impacts were assessed. So this wasn't intended to assess the number of per people, it was for economic impacts. As an example, the vast majority of this 97% are small farmers treating irrigation ditches. And in its calculations, EPA assumed that all potentially covered farmers were treating every irrigation ditch with pesticides, and that every single one of those irrigation ditches was a water of the United States that's regulated under the Clean Water Act. So what we dispute in the 97% is the denominator, is the total of 14,000 individuals who are covered by the permit. As you can tell, this, you know, every farmer is treating every ditch and every ditch is a water, that highly inflates the number of individuals who are actually covered by the permit. And so that's why EPA disputes that 97%. But Judge Callahan, as you noted, what's more important here are the individuals and the folks who are part of this 97% or this majority. And these are the small dischargers, as EPA calls them. They're going to be the homeowners, small farmers, small businesses, whereas the large permittees, which are the folks who are required to submit notices of intent, these are going to be your large government entities, your pest control agencies, such as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Forest Service. So EPA determined that the volume of discharges, and this determination is at SER 417, the volume of discharges and potential impact to water quality from these large permittees is going to be substantially greater than from the smaller permittees. So
Why would it be inappropriate for them to submit an NOI?
Sure, Your Honor.
Not be helpful. It might not. But how is it inappropriate? That's a weird. You know, that's a higher standard.
Well, I would like to know. The EPA's position is that inappropriate grants a lot of deference to EPA. And so with that, EPA determined that it's inappropriate for this vast majority of folks to submit notices of intent because of the burden. And petitioners note that there is
inappropriate for the discharge or inappropriate for EPA?
Well, both, Your Honor. It causes a burden to the permittee for a lack of information that EPA would need. So as noted, EPA concluded that these are small dischargers that are going to have relatively low impact to water quality and low volumes. And so EPA determined that that information would be of low value to them with a relatively large burden to the permittee. And as I noted, petitioner...
And you have to look at it, too.
EPA has to look at it. And one thing, I wanted to go back to the burden, because I think that's getting glossed over here, is only, you know, a couple bucks to submit one of these NOIs, but that's not the case. At SER 3480, there's an analysis of what the burden would be, and EPA concluded that it would be hundreds of dollars and hours of time, and this is just after the permittee finds it on the website, registers with EPA. You know, for an entity who is used to doing this, for the Fish and Wildlife Service, that's quick, that's easy, that is low burden. And that's why these significant dischargers submit these notices of intent. For you, for me, I will tell you, I tried to find it online and it was difficult. For a layperson who is simply applying pesticides in their backyard, or a small farm that's trying to do this, That is a burden that EPA needed to consider. And this is the important factor and an important balancing act that EPA did with this permit. It's a highly technical decision that EPA is owed significant deference to, as held by this court in San Luis and Delta Mendota. This is a technical decision that EPA had really difficult considerations, and it properly balanced those technical considerations.
The wording in the statute that allows the EPA to adopt the inappropriate standard, because inappropriate to me has an element of subjectivity, such as a white suit at a funeral is an inappropriate suit, right? It doesn't seem very objective to me to say, to allow the EPA to say, well, this is inappropriate. Maybe they don't like the flavor of it or the smell of it. It seems like a very difficult to apply standard.
Your Honor, I want to mention a couple things about statutory arguments here. Number one, petitioners waive any statutory arguments here because in their comments, they don't raise any sort of comment that the permit is incompatible with the statute, and there are no arguments in their opening brief that the permit is inconsistent with the statute. But more importantly, what's at issue here is the validity of the pesticide general permit, not the general permit regulations. And this inappropriate standard is within the general permit standards. So what's at issue here is whether the pesticide general permit is consistent with the general permit regulations. And EPA's record and brief shows that it clearly is consistent with that with those regulations. But regardless, going to your question about statutory interpretation, the statute does clearly confer discretion on EPA to determine the appropriate information gathering techniques and requirements. So looking at 33 U.S.C. 1342A1-2, which is the...
What deference are you allowed?
EPA is owed arbitrary and capricious deference for its determination about which individuals should not submit notices of intent. And going back to the statutory language here, it makes clear that this is a highly deferential standard, even in the statutory sense. So one key term that petitioners leave out when they read the statute is, and such requirements as he deems appropriate. This is clearly deferential language that allows EPA the authority to make the highly technical decision about what information, what data is appropriate, and what EPA needs to run its programs.
So this has been going on for a bit, right?
We've
been fighting about this for a bit of time. And I'm curious of your perspective from the standpoint, I don't know how the court's going to decide this case, but then at a point that we do decide it, we can do it either in a memorandum disposition or we can do it in a published opinion. Is there any value to publication in this area?
I don't have a position on that from EPA, Your Honor. I don't have a position from EPA. I think if it was a published opinion, obviously if you sided with us, we'd love it to be published. But I think there are some.
I'm just trying to decide to the parties, mm-hmm. Is there any value to saying whether this is good enough or it's not good enough? Is it arbitrary and capricious? Or, does that end anything, or is just going to be... You all sat here this morning. Is it just going to be another ongoing saga?
Well, Your Honor, the permit, this kind of goes to the length of the permit. So this is a limited 5-year permit. So it's going to expire.
Right. And then we start again.
So the benefit of any sort of decision here saying that this was, I'm going to assume for the benefit here that you say it's a wonderful permit and it's not arbitrary and capricious. But to the extent that that kind of decision is made, it would inform how EPA writes its next iteration of the permit. So a published opinion would have assistance in that regard. helping with the next iterations of the permit. Also, I want to note, while we're on the topic of remedy, no party here requests vacatur, and so any remedy that would be appropriate here would be remand without vacatur, which would allow the permit to stay in place while it's remanded to the agency for any sort of reconsideration consistent with this court's opinion. I would like to turn to monitoring, if the court is okay with that. I know petitioners spent a bit of time on that, and so I want...
Yeah, regarding the permit's monitoring requirements, petitioners submitted comments that EPA should require stricter visual monitoring requirements. Why did the permit eventually adopt a standard that permitted considerations of quote-unquote safety and quote-unquote feasibility?
Your Honor, it would have been inappropriate and unreasonable for EPA to not consider feasibility and safety. So the Clean Water Act regulatory and statutory scheme grants EPA discretion to craft the appropriate monitoring requirements for each permit, and this court held that in Food and Water Watch. Here, EPA appropriately accounted for feasibility and safety, like I said, because it would have been inappropriate not to. So these are applications of pesticides where oftentimes it's going to be folks going out into forests and applying it. Sometimes applications will happen at the dark. It would be inappropriate and unreasonable for EPA to say to pesticide applicators, it doesn't matter if it's safe or not, you have to monitor. And EPA ultimately came to this decision with regard to the visual monitoring after ruling out the different alternative types of monitoring approaches. So unlike petitioner's contention, it's not that EPA threw up its hands. It's EPA made a considered determination after evaluating the various forms of monitoring and decided that this was the best option. So starting with the pesticides at point of discharge, that would simply indicate the type and amount of product applied, which is already known through annual reports. Additionally, the amount applied does not reflect the amount of pollutant that ultimately reaches regulated waters. So unlike traditional end-of-pipe discharges, chemical pesticide applications contain both the portion serving the pesticide intended purpose and the potential chemical residue, which is all that's regulated under the Clean Water Act. So EPA decided that was an inappropriate mode because it wouldn't give us appropriate information. Second, EPA noted that sampling receiving waters was similarly inappropriate. It wouldn't generally distinguish whether water quality impacts were made from the permittee or another source. And this is made doubly difficult because of the issue of only the residue being regulated by the Clean Water Act.
I had a question on that point. If water testing can't determine who was the pollutant or discharger, I guess is the word, how would a visual observation tell that then?
Well, that's why the visual monitoring at the time of application is what EPA determined was appropriate.
Oh, because they're observing at the time.
They're observing, yes. Yeah. So the visual monitoring is occurring at the time of impact, correct.
But what's your response that it takes some time for the pollutant to have an effect?
Sure. A couple of responses. Number one, and I mentioned this briefly, that I started mentioning this earlier, and I think it's an important underscore to this entire permit, are the underlying protections of FIFRA. So with FIFRA, EPA already undergoes an analysis to understand the toxicity to human health and the environment of each individual pesticide. So it's an individual pesticide determination. With that, EPA then implements mitigation measures that pesticide applicants have to use when they apply the pesticide to mitigate or wholly eliminate the risks. So petitioner's contention that it might happen later, if these pesticides are being used in accordance with the labels under FIFRA, which the permit requires it be done, the mitigation measures in place should avoid that. But secondarily, the permit also requires individuals to go back to the point of application for post-treatment review and monitoring. And the record shows that EPA concluded that would occur because individuals typically go back in the standard course of business. So, for example, You may go back if you want to make sure that your pesticide was effective. And this is often something that will also be on the pesticide label. It'll require you to go back to make sure that it was effective or go back for reapplications, for example.
Well, your friend on the other side sort of listed the parade of horribles of what the things that you might be missing by not looking, not by exempting 97% of the people. So what's your response to that? I mean, obviously, none of us would want, even though someone was a small discharger, but it was something terribly toxic, and then kill everyone at school or something like that. But it wasn't very much. It just was enough to kill everyone. So what's your response to that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And EPA did consider that with its consideration of FIFRA and how that's the underlying foundation of the pesticide general permit. So the pesticide general permit is not acting on its own. The pesticide general permit is an additional layer of protection that we are afforded on top of all of the protections provided by FIFRA. And it's true that there are different standards that FIFRA set for health and safety and toxicity versus the Clean Water Act, and that's something that petitioners point out. But that doesn't change the fact that there is this underlying protection provided by FIFRA. Also, FIFRA checks for toxicity in human drinking water, and that doesn't have a cost-benefit analysis protection. So there are these underlying mitigation measures and underlying safety mechanisms that are set. On top of that is the permit. And this is what the permit does, is it's that additional layer that provides safety. So the parade of horribles is really just, it's not an accurate depiction of what is happening. And this is evidenced by the fact that the information EPA has looked at about water quality effects across the country has shown that there are no negative impacts of the permit on that. And Your Honor, I see I'm running out of time. I think I've covered all main points.
Let me find out if either of my colleagues have any, if we have any questions. Okay, we don't appear to have any additional questions, so you can wrap up.
Okay, thank you so much, Your Honor. I would just like to say, again, the pesticide general permit is a highly technical permit that EPA utilized its technical deference, experience, and consultation internally with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the public to develop. Its iterations have been developed over years and years and years, and EPA has been making improvements since the beginning of the permit, including the improvements implemented in this permit after consultation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and NMFS. For all the foregoing reasons and those set forth in our brief, EPA respectfully requests this court deny the petition for review.
Thank you. All right, we'll hear rebuttal.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Your rebuttal.
Thank you. I need my reading glasses. So the United States has not put forward any plausible theory of how Congress intended to have an NPDES permitting scheme effectively leave out most of the people that are getting coverage under that permit. And we have not heard a statutory basis for that decision yet. And in our back and forth earlier, we were sort of getting at the issue of line drawing and what is okay to exempt and what is not. One point that I wanted to make is that it's Congress who gets to decide whether entities can be exempt from the NPDES permit. Congress knows how to do that. In defense of this NOI exemption in its briefing, EPA relies on the vessel general permit.
Didn't you concede to me that the congressional act here is the Clean Water Act, and you said that there isn't anything about that in the Clean Water Act?
Correct. And what I'm saying is that Congress, if it wanted to exempt this category of dischargers, it's Congress who has to do that. EPA doesn't have the authority to do that. And in fact, Congress knows how to do that.
But you're not challenging the reg here, right, that allows them to exempt any NOI that's inappropriate.
We're not directly, Judge Bumate, but the application of that regulation here in such a sweeping manner runs up against the statutory mandate to assure compliance with the permit terms. And we have not heard a plausible statutory theory as to why this is acceptable from the government.
Right. Well, and, I mean, if you brought a challenge to the reg, then that comes full circle. I mean, directly at issue. But now I think we're left with the regs, which says they can't exempt those that are inappropriate. And then we just have to determine whether or not it's inappropriate or not.
Right. And I mean, we've laid out in our briefs all the reasons why the record doesn't support the what we think is arbitrary line drawing that results in 97% of the permittees not having to be a part of the scheme. EPA stood up, or DOJ stood up and said that they don't adopt that number. We don't know another number. We do know that there is a large percentage of permittees who are not required to do the most basic things under this permit. Now, counsel for the government also spent quite a bit of time talking about FFRA, and we talk a lot about this a lot in our briefs. And the continued reliance on FFRA is simply not supported by the law. As we lay out in our briefs, this issue has already been decided both by this court and by the National Cotton Council Court in the Sixth Circuit. That decision came out 17 years ago, and here we are still talking about FFRA being enough to get us to compliance with the Clean Water Act. FFRA is a cost-benefit analysis when it comes to water quality. The Clean Water Act is not. FFRA is a national statute that doesn't take into consideration any particular concerns of any particular water body or any particular species. The Clean Water Act requires those things.
Can you address what, you know, they're saying that FFRA, the observation requirement, monitoring requirement is sufficient given the FFRA background, contextual background. What's your response to that?
It is not adequate because FFRA doesn't require any monitoring of any kind. FFRA registers pesticides, and there are labels that presumably pesticide applicators.
But do you agree that FFRA requires them to go back to the spot to make sure the pesticide was effective, and then if they observe something then they have to report it?
Well, what I understood counsel for the government to be saying is that in the ordinary course of business, some pesticide applicators do this. But when we're looking at this from a Clean Water Act perspective, an NPDES permit, which is built on self-monitoring and self-reporting, there is no requirement to go back and look after the pesticide has been applied.
If you comply with FFRA, I think the argument would be if you comply with FFRA, you will go back and monitor, but...
So I disagree that that is adequate to satisfy the requirements under the Clean Water Act, because there's also no evidence in the record to suggest that this is actually being done. EPA has sort of tied its own hands by not collecting information over the years. And this is, I know I'm almost out of time.
Do you want to comment to me whether you think there's any value to publication here?
Your Honor, I think these are important issues, particularly the two issues I focused on today, the lack of monitoring and the lack of NOIs for most of the dischargers here. The permit has been through, this is the fourth iteration. We haven't had a judicial opinion on it, and these are important issues, again, especially those two. I think the court was suggesting we're just going to keep fighting about this, that maybe that will be true, but if we can get a ruling, of course, that says EPA is required to have monitoring that is representative of the activity at issue and to sweep in all of the dischargers who are to require the most basic information from all the dischargers under this permit, that would be valuable moving forward.
So either of you, basically, if you win, it's worthy. If you don't, then let's keep fighting, right? I got it. Okay. Do you want to wrap up?
Well, I think that was a good wrap up. The only other thing I was going to say is this is reminiscent of in a recent Supreme Court decision, Justice Alito, on the Clean Water Act. Justice Alito gave an analogy of where a state mandates that a school that the students have to learn certain skills to solve a statewide math test, and the principal wouldn't just say to the teachers, go tell the students, make sure you pass the test. Mm-hmm. They would actually implement steps necessary to make sure that the students pass the test. So essentially what EPA is doing here, it is a trust but don't actually verify that everybody is following the rules with no requirement to submit any information on what they're doing. So,
all right. Thank you for your argument. Thank you both for your argument here today. This matter will stand submitted. This court is in recess until tomorrow at 9 a.m.